I'm Eric Scott. It's Friday. Hello there. And that means our guest this afternoon is State Senator Jeb Bradley. Of course, Wolfboro resident. Senator, thank you for being with us today.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you, Eric?
I am very well, sir. Things are going well. Well, congratulations. You and your colleagues deserve definitely to have one poured out in your honor to get this thing over the finish line.
You know what? I voted on a lot of different budgets, you know, going back to when I was in the New Hampshire House, before a member of the U.S. Congress, and now the New Hampshire Senate. And budgets are probably always the most difficult vote because they're a collection of different agenda items, and some you like better than others. And nobody gets everything they want in the budget. And because of that, and because they're so broad in their scope, they often have, you know, some people have to prioritize what they like and what they don't like, and then make a decision whether they're going to vote for it or not. And it's always the toughest vote. Now, I happen to think this is a really good budget. It really focuses on helping people in New Hampshire, whether it's mental health or child protection, prevention of child abuse, funding for families with a disabled child, affordable housing got a huge boost in funding, and that's something that we need. But it's also going to make New Hampshire more competitive in terms of our business tax rate. And, you know, everybody has said the sky is falling when we first started to lower business taxes. They said we'd lose revenue. Well, guess what? We haven't. Business tax revenue has gone up, and really gone up significantly. It's that new revenue has allowed us to do a number of things, but it's also set the stage for the fact that we have the lowest unemployment rate in the country. That's pretty amazing, but it gets even more amazing when you think that we have the lowest rate of poverty in the country. And so you combine those two things with the job opportunity and the tight job market that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity here in New Hampshire, and Wallet Hub rates us as one of the top states to open a business in. U.S. News and World Reports rates us as one of the top states to live in. And so, you know, the budget has to make the economy competitive, and I think it did that, and it obviously protects taxpayers too. So overall, a really good budget. And one of the key things, and I would have thought this would have generated some bipartisan support, because our revenues have been so strong, we're able to provide about $400 million for local property taxpayers, whether it's $100 million more for schools, whether it's nearly $200 million in the rooms and meals revenue sharing formula, whether it's the $80 million for local roads and bridges. There's a lot of property tax relief in this bill, and I think, you know, that's a message that people have heard loud and clear. No one wants an income tax or sales tax, or, well, I shouldn't say no one. There are probably a few people that do, but for the most part, New Hampshire residents do not embrace the sales, income, or capital gains tax, but they, you know, do complain about higher property taxes. Well, guess what? This budget is going to provide some significant assistance there.
And that's fantastic. What is, or was there anything really different about this bill and session as opposed to previous ones that you've done?
Well, being out of the building, it was harder to have face-to-face discussions. That was one thing. The second thing, you know, the economy has recovered substantially, and our revenue picture is so much better. When we were talking this time last year, you know, I mean, a week before the end of fiscal 20, at the end of June, and we knew we were facing a large revenue deficit. We've more than made up that deficit and blasted by it, so that this budget, when it closes, you know, next week on June 30th, I think June is going to be, from what I've heard, it's going to be another very strong month, revenue-wise, and it should continue as long as the economy stays strong.
Okay. How has the flip from Democrat to Republican control affected the process?
Well, no matter who's in charge, they have to produce a budget.
Right.
So, that's one thing. I think what we've focused on, has been the economic side of things, making New Hampshire more competitive because the Best Social Program's a good job. And when you lower business taxes, you become more competitive. When you lower workers' compensation costs, you become more competitive. But at the same time, we have a responsibility for, people that need help, whether it's, mental health or substance abuse or child prevention and abuse. And by the way, there was a study that came out, I think, earlier this week that had New Hampshire as the number two state in child protection. Now, I'm not saying everything's perfect in New Hampshire. It isn't. And there are things that we need to continue to do. But when you rank New Hampshire against, the other 49 states, and we're number two, that's a pretty darn good thing.
It is. What are some of the reasons, the underlying reasons, you think things are going so well right now?
I think that New Hampshire people are ready to get back to work. I think that Governor Sununu did an exceptional job, quite frankly, of managing through the pandemic and trying to keep, businesses open as much as possible. It wasn't always possible. I know people in the hospitality industry were, pretty adversely affected by some of the guidelines that the governor created for social distancing. But the reality is, people weren't going out to restaurants once the weather turned in November and you couldn't sit outside as much. So, there was definitely people that were hurt by it. There's no question about that. But I think that part of the fact that we've recovered so well is, Sununu's balancing of the need to protect public health with the need to keep the economy as open as possible. And I think as other localities around the country have experienced problems, whether it was crime waves in cities or just not as good a pandemic response, even in states that had much tighter lockdown requirements, people have come to New Hampshire and said, wow, this is good, you're open. And, people are actually trying to move here now, and our in-migration has been up. And so I think that that's contributed to, the good revenue picture, because businesses have bounced back pretty strongly in New Hampshire.
I know it'll take a while for everything to get counted and fall out. It may even be another year or two, but do we have any idea how many people have moved to New Hampshire over the last, say, 18 months?
I don't know, but I know our in-migration has been relatively strong. There are some states doing even better. I mean, Texas and Florida, off the charts. But, I think we're kind of a beacon of, job opportunity, free enterprise, our live free or die spirit in the Northeast. Certainly New Hampshire is known for that. I think people that, appreciate that lifestyle have wanted to come here. And, hey, we're going into summer. And today seems like the first real day of summer for me because the budget has passed and, we don't have to deal with a continuing resolution and trying to pick up the pieces if it hadn't passed. But there are a lot of people coming to New Hampshire to visit this summer, and that's a great thing.
Yes, it is. I hear the state parks did very well, and bookings for July 4th weekend are up. By the way, so if you you might want to check with your favorite state park to make sure that they don't require a reservation. Just a little helpful.
I don't
hint.
Think that most are requiring reservations this summer. I know that Washington State Park last year had a reservation system, but this year not.
Okay. Well, just the same, check with your local park and make sure before you go. Should be a lot of fun, though. Fishing game is, I was hearing an interview with them on another radio station that says this is kind of like their Super Bowl. They're gearing up for their busy season. Question, Senator. If you could wave your magic wand and put whatever you wanted into the budget, what would you have wanted that didn't get in there?
Well, there are a couple of things that I would have liked to have seen in there. The Medicaid dental benefit was one. You know, a lot of work's gone into it. And, you know, in terms of the cost and the benefit, I think the cost is, you know, fairly nominal in the $6 million range. But the benefit is pretty significant. Good oral health is good for good overall health, and certainly poor oral health exacerbates a lot of you know, other health issues. Not only that, but having the ability to have dental work done will help people get back into the workforce, and Medicaid expansion has proven that. I think a dental benefit would too. But, you know, there was some concern about the expense, so it has been deferred for discussion next year, and I think that's what will happen, and I hope it will pass next year. There was another provision that, for whatever reason, our friends in the House voted it down, so they couldn't rule-wise put it back into the budget, even though we explained it to them. There were some businesses that were startup businesses that had only been in operation for a few months before the pandemic and the lockdowns hit, and they were never eligible for the payroll protection plan dollars. And so we put a provision into, you know, the Senate had voted for it to allow in any future situation like this that they would be eligible for funding, but the House had unfortunately voted it down. So even though I think members of the committee of conference would have approved it, they felt they couldn't because of their rules. So those are two things that I would have liked to have seen in the budget. But, you know, overall, I think it's a really good budget. I have no complaints.
Out of curiosity, as far as the dental plan, you said it was $6 million, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Could you have had $394 million in property tax relief and then fund Medicaid, or is that am I off in left field someplace?
No, I think that we our friends in the House hadn't had a public hearing on it, and they felt that, you know, in order to convince 400 people, it should have had a public hearing in the House. There was a similar bill that had a public hearing in the House, but that's just, you know, what they felt. There was a provision that, you know, I asked, and I was on the committee of conference, and I asked that it be stripped out, that dealt with the Sununu Center, and the closing of the Sununu Center, and it's a criminal justice reform for young offenders so that it would divert people away from, you know, basically what is juvenile detention at the Sununu Center. And I thought, boy, we haven't had a public hearing on this, and I felt burned by bail reform a couple of years ago that, you know, because the effect of bail reform, and in New Hampshire it's not as bad as in other states, but still, people have gotten just released without bail and within hours sometimes have recommitted violent crimes. And so I, having had that happen, and the examples that police chiefs have brought to me, you know, about what's happened with adult bail reform, it was like, no, we're not doing this juvenile justice reform without a full-fledged hearing and the opportunity to, you know, think long and hard about what we want to do with this. So, you know, I was one of the lead negotiators for the Senate, and so I sort of you know, put my tap the brakes a little bit on that one because it hadn't had any scrutiny in the Senate, just as our friends in the House did the same on the dental benefits. So it happens.
If you did close the Sununu Center, where would you detain?
So we're going to have to build a new facility.
Ah, okay.
And the Sununu Center is this huge, sprawling facility that was designed to hold about 150 kids at any one time. Community-based programs do a better job of trying to divert kids away from having to go to something like the Sununu Center. So there's certainly not 150 kids, and we're down to under 20 most of the time. And when we first started having significant discussions about either reforming the Sununu Center or closing it, the average membership was around 60 or 70 kids. Now it's down below 20. And so the thought is we'll have to repay the federal government for the grant to build the buildings, but that property in Manchester is, you know, so well placed, and who knows what it could be used for, but it definitely has value. So build a new smaller building that would house up to 18 or 20 kids, and develop the community programs even further, and hopefully, you know, that works out much better, especially given some of the problems that have come to light recently about, you know, past abuses at the Sununu Center.
What exactly are the community programs of which you...
They're like juvenile diversion programs.
Okay.
You know, counseling and working with a family and things like that to try to, you know, keep at-risk youth out of trouble without putting them in a detention facility.
Okay, that makes sense. So that piece of land would either be sold off or redeveloped with a different facility?
Yeah, I mean, that would be, and, you know, probably go back into the private sector. So I think that'd be good for Manchester. And, you know, the state would be able to recoup its investment, if you will, in tearing down the buildings and repaying the federal government for the grant that, you know, went into it. So it's a very valuable piece of real estate.
I'm sure it is. Out of curiosity, though, you had mentioned bail reform, and sometimes these people get out and within a matter of hours, they were arrested again. What precautions would that, in other words, how do we know it's not going to happen with teenagers?
And that is the entire point of why you have a public hearing and plenty of scrutiny and bring, you know, all the people that need to be at the table to the table. And the proposal that came into the Committee of Conference had been written by advocates for closing the Sununu Center. And clearly, they, you know, are a very important piece to the discussion. But I also want to have law enforcement at the table and, you know, understand the practical realities of, okay, if you change this law to try to divert somebody away from, you know, juvenile detention, that's all well and good in, you know, in theory, okay? But in the practical world, you also don't want to be letting a violent offender who happens to be a juvenile, you know, to escape sort of consequences. And I think we've seen that with adult bail reform that was intended to give people the same, you know, opportunity to not have to, you know, especially lower income people should be able to have access to bail that, you know, more affluent means have. But in the real world, what's happened is that you know, whether it's bail commissioners or judges, have just let people out based on the law without having to go through the bail process. And they could have been a risk to themselves, or they've been a risk to others. And, you know, there have been a number of examples of, you know, violent behavior that occurred right after an arrest. I mean, there was one situation in Portsmouth that, as I recall, you know, led this offender, led police on a chase, ended up ramming the police car. I'm doing this from memory, so if I don't have all the details right, I apologize. But at any rate, he was arrested, bailed or no bail that night, so released. And the next day, he tried to start a fire at one of the, you know, local schools in Portsmouth. So, I mean, this is not good behavior. And yeah, we should, I think, you know, we need to reform our bail reform laws, because despite everybody's best intention, I don't think they've worked in the way that they should have worked in all cases. And so, you know, if you're charged with a violent crime, or, you know, things like child pornography, I don't think bail should, or you should be released automatically. I think you should have to go before a judge. And that was one of the, you know, issues that I brought up in a piece of legislation that got through the Senate on a bipartisan basis, but got stalled in the House. And so I don't want to see us just listen to the advocates of closing the Sununu Center because they think, oh, these, you know, kids are whatever. And, you know, if they are treated differently, they won't be violent. Well, I want law enforcement at the table to make sure that we also have the ability to deal with violent juvenile offenders appropriately. And, you know, I keep saying this. We need safe homes, safe streets, safe schools. And our bail reform laws in New Hampshire undermined that somewhat. In other areas of the country, undermined it pretty significantly. So I'm one of those look before you leap type of people, and that comes to the Sununu Center.
Our guest this afternoon, Senator Jeb Bradley, Senate Majority Leader and Wolfboro resident. Thank you again for making the time. How did your some of your pet projects make it? The broadband bill, net metering, I guess, made it?
Net metering will go to the governor. He has said he's going to sign it. Broadband, same thing, will go to the governor. He's going to sign that. So I feel, you know, a lot of my legislation did pretty well, and I'm happy about that.
Tell me, and I know that we've talked about it in the past, but for those who may not have heard it the first time, tell me about this broadband bill, because it's unfortunately not available to a lot of people.
Yeah, no, and that's the problem, especially in the, you know, more rural areas of the state. You know, the way cable or even phone DSL lines are installed, unless you have enough volume of houses per mile, you don't get wire laid down those streets, and they're generally back roads and things like that. But those people need broadband just as much as anybody else. And so what this bill does is create a matching grant initiative using federal funding, and it could in the future be state funding, but there's going to be a lot of federal funding for broadband that would match dollars raised either by a community or by a provider to go into, you know, deploying wires in, you know, these harder to reach places. And so, you know, I think that it will over the next couple of years provide, you know, a lot more access to people that don't have much right now.
Okay. And the net metering, that's for people who have solar panels?
It could be, either solar panels or you know, other forms of renewable energy. Most people are net meter with solar right now, but it could be wind, or it could be hydro facilities. And so what this'll do, will allow towns to exceed the 1 megawatt cap and go up to 5 megawatts in solar projects or hydro or whatever, and be able to net meter any of the excess power. So we had a cap of 1 megawatt. We've been trying to get it expanded, and the agreement was, okay, we'll expand it for municipalities.
Okay. So you could have a town-owned alternative energy generator that would be able to net meter.
Yes, and it could be run privately, but it would have to be a town project.
Okay. All right, it's 1228 here on WASR. Thank you very much for being here with us today. Couple of things. What is, Senator, engrossing a bill? I meant to ask that, and I forgot last week.
I think you mean enrolling.
No, engrossed. At least that's what was on
Bill. I have no idea.
Oh, okay, well, that was Bill Track's website. Maybe I'll work with them. However, enrolled was the next question, so let's work with that.
So when a bill gets enrolled, there's the possibility, if there are technical fixes to a bill, you know, sometimes the wrong citation or poor grammar or even could be misspelling or poor punctuation. So as long as it doesn't change the, you know, impact of a bill, the content of a bill, the policy direction of the bill, but just improves the writing of it and the language of it, there can be an enrolled bill that comes after the process of having been voted on in whatever the final step is, you know, in the House and Senate. So I'm on the Rules Committee, and as a member of the Rules Committee, I also serve on the Enrolled Bills Committee. So I had to sign an enrolled bill yesterday that there was, I think the sentence was repeated like with a two and a two, T-O-T-O, only needed to be one. So if one needed to be deleted. That's the kind of thing that an enrolled bill does. And it's sort of the last stop before it goes to the governor for signature.
Okay. So anything that's enrolled has already been through the process, pretty much.
It's already been through the House and Senate. You know, it's passed both the House and Senate. So it's on its way to the governor. But any of the technical changes, grammar or punctuation or, you know, an incorrect citation or something like that would happen in the enrolled bills process. And then it goes to the Secretary of State, Senate President for signature, and House Speaker, and then it goes right to the governor.
Okay. Next question. Today is the day there'll be a partial declassification of a whole bunch of those UFO reports out at Area 51. And I was just curious what you thought about that.
You know, not a lot, to tell you the truth. I mean, that's more of a federal issue. I'm glad that there is a declassification effort underway, and it's interesting to see what, you know, comes out of it. But it's not my issue, per se. But like everybody else, I do have kind of an interest in, you know, what may be out there.
You think there's somebody out there looking at us going, I don't know, guys, what do you think?
I have no idea.
Sometimes, no idea. I, you know, it depends on what time of the day it is, I think, sometimes. Sometimes I believe it and sometimes I don't. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
All right, what are some of the most common reasons that constituents reach out to you?
It can be any number of things. I mean, during the pandemic, I had several hundred people that needed help with unemployment. It was a little bit more complicated to file for unemployment, and it was in some ways more difficult because there were so many people that became so suddenly unemployed, and so it was electronic, and sometimes there were just simple mistakes made, or people needed to provide more information to the Department of Employment Security, so they got rejection notices. And so they get a rejection notice and they qualify, and they're still being rejected. Who do they call? They call me, which is what they should have done. And, you know, I talked to an awful lot of people, and I think all but one or two, we were able to, you know, by going through the Department of Employment Security, get, you know, their unemployment compensation turned on appropriately, and that was a good thing. Hear a lot about, you know, road issues. Certainly that's something that affects everybody. But then, you know, the whole range of issues.
Okay. Out of curiosity, as far as the DES is concerned, the fact that you need to get involved at all, does that tell me that there's something wrong with the process?
No, not really. It was one of the things that happened with unemployment compensation during the pandemic is you could be self-employed. And that's not usually the case for unemployment. So that was a complicating factor. Then, you know, the information that was required, and also because there were so many people that were signing up, there were certain times that you could sign up based on the first letter of your last name, and if you missed that, you know, so it was just, it was a little bit more difficult when there were 140,000 people at the peak that were applying for unemployment, and normally our unemployment is maybe 20 to 25,000. So it was just the pressure of the huge number of people, I think.
Well, now that the worst seems to be over, if unemployment is at 2.5%, the drain on the trust fund must have been mitigated.
So the trust fund's starting to restore itself. I think one of the things that we should do is we have, you know, more access to the ARRA funding from Washington. I'd like to see us put a chunk of that money into the unemployment trust fund so we can mitigate against a tax increase for businesses. You know, that through no fault of their own, they're having to pay surcharges today. I think that would be an appropriate place to spend some of these dollars.
Now, to do that, you need to introduce a bill and go through the process, correct?
I think that most of this money is going to go through the fiscal committee, which, you know, I serve on sometimes. It's generally higher ranking members of the finance committee or leadership. So I've subbed for, you know, Senator Morris or other members in the past, but I'm virtually certain that could go through the fiscal committee. One of the good things about this budget that was just signed yesterday is projected to fully fund the rainy day fund, which would be in the $160 million range. And that's up probably $50 million from where, you know, we are now. And that's a good thing. You should, you know, have enough money to survive for a while, even if, you know, the revenue is not there.
It's been almost miraculous, the recovery from the pandemic shocks. You know, it's funny, one of the things you can't get now is pool chlorine. I thought that was fascinating. We have been going nuts. We finally found some at one of the big box stores, but we had to try four different stores before we found one that had it. That's the latest thing on the pandemic now is chlorine. All right. Does that mean the price of bleach goes up? I I'm not sure. Anyway, I want to talk to you about some of the bills that that I saw, if you don't mind. One of which is Senate Bill 40. This one fascinates me because I'm interested in this particular kind of law that allows warrantless search of a motor vehicle with the consent of the operator. Well, I thought we already had that. So I'm a little funny as to why we would need a bill for that.
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
Oh, well, we'll have to cover that next week as SB 40.
Yeah, I'm looking it up right now.
Oh, okay. One of the other interesting pieces of the bill were that, at least on paper, the police officer can't use that as a piece of information to detain you or to arrest you. It's interesting. All right, well, we'll move on that one. Senate Bill 22, which is the Lucky 7 tickets?
Yes.
Quick question, and maybe it's me. We have numbers games, you know, 7 days a week. We have Mega Ball, Powerball, or Mega Millions, whatever it is, the scratch tickets, and, of course, the Lucky 7 tickets that you buy at bingo games and such like that. Why have we just not said, you know what, let's just do it and authorized a casino gambling license or two?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that there's been broad and bipartisan opposition to having casinos in New Hampshire, despite the fact that we have things like the lottery or Lucky 7 or charitable gaming is a huge initiative now, too. The charities actually, you know, receive the proceeds of, you know, the gaming operation. But I think people have been reluctant to have casinos in New Hampshire because of, you know, some of the social costs of gambling. And now, you know, I almost wonder if New Hampshire could have a casino just based on, you know, the fact that states around us have them with more proximity, and whether we could, you know, have one that would be justified. So I don't know the answer to that, though.
Well, you'd think that if there was an opportunity, there'd be probably more discussion on that subject.
Well, it's been discussed for a long, long time, and there was, you know, for years, a lot of support for it, you know, a casino at Rockingham Park in Salem. But now that, you know, there are alternative proposals to build at Rockingham Park, the desire for it seems to have waned somewhat.
I always thought it should be in the North Country, you know, to give ski areas a four-season destination.
And I think that, you know, some of the North Country hotels, the big hotels, you know, might have liked to have seen, you know, casino gambling proposal. But I don't know. To me, a casino is, I don't know. I worry about problem gambling. I worry about, I worry more, I guess, about becoming addicted to the revenue stream and then not, you know, if it doesn't meet its targets, which it doesn't always do, then what do? You know, and do you build more casinos? I mean, where some people probably could accept, you know, one casino in the North Country and maybe one, you know, in southern New Hampshire, and that might not change the way that we are as a state. I think people would not like it if there were half a dozen of them throughout the state. I think it would be different.
Well,
so that concerns me. You get addicted to the revenue, and then you just open up the doors even more.
Well, as far as problem gambling, I would think that if you have a problem, you don't need to go far to engage.
And I get that. I get, you know, that is the argument that people use, that, hey, you can go to Maine, you can go to Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island to gamble. You know, what are you solving, Jeb? And that's a legitimate argument.
Well, Well, that's what I figure. If people are going to go there, why wouldn't they stay here? But then you start getting into competition, and would the market support it, and a whole bunch of other intangibles.
Yeah, well, I think that is, an issue now, as states around us have, opened up their states to more casino operations. Could New Hampshire support one, and would it, if you do it based on the revenue that you're going to get, and you don't get that revenue, but you plan on spending it, then that's when it opens the door to even more casinos. So, I don't know.
I mean, I don't think anybody wants one, on every street corner like Starbucks.
No, I don't think so.
But anyway, getting back to the Lucky 7 tickets, I noticed that in the Senate Bill 22, it caps the price at $1.
Yes.
Is and again, maybe because I don't play bingo, I don't play Lucky 7, I'm not really a big gamer except for blackjack. Why would you need to do that? I mean, if you wanted to sell $2 tickets, what's the problem?
You know what? I don't know the answer to that either.
Well, that's fair. Okay. That's fair.
I think the thought was that if you raise the price too much, then it'll undermine people's willingness to buy them. But I'm not sure about that.
I think, well, like everything else, I mean, we have, what, $20 scratch tickets?
Yeah.
I'm sure they don't sell in the same volumes as the $1 scratch tickets, but...
So they don't. You're right.
But there's a market for them, or they wouldn't be selling them.
And, again, I'm not sure. Didn't go through a committee I am on, so I wasn't part of that public hearing.
Okay. Another one is Senate Bill 3, which exempts PPP loan money from the business profits tax.
Now that's a bill I can answer questions on because it was my bill.
Okay.
So I was the sponsor of that bill. When the federal government, in the CARES Act, created the Payroll Protection Plan, it was designed to be, as long as you did what you were supposed to do with the money, which was, largely use it for payroll and keeping people on the job, that it would turn into a grant and it would not be taxable, okay? And it was pegged on the 2020 IRS code. New Hampshire does not have a provision in law that automatically updates our tax compliance with the federal code. So we're still on the 2018 code. And so suddenly, because of the fact that we were on the 2018 code, payroll protection was taxable. But it was never intended to be taxable by the feds. It was intended to keep people on the job and keep the economy afloat, which, I have to say, it largely did. It was successful. But it shouldn't have been a taxable event in New Hampshire. So we had to pass a statute that said, was not going to be a taxable event, and then account for it in the budget. I think the estimates of the amount of revenue loss were probably higher than the actuality of it will be. But, it is law now. The governor signed it a couple of weeks ago, and I think every accountant was really happy, because the people that were calling me up the most is like, when is this going to happen, because we have to do tax filings.
Oh, yeah, I never thought of that. But according to the DRA, they say the impact of the bill was $99 million. You think it's going to
be less? And I don't think it's going to be that high.
Right.
But it is, according to that fiscal analysis, spread out over 2 or 3 years. So even if it is, it's a manageable amount of money over a 2 or 3 year period.
Well, I mean, you'd think that the money was tax money to begin with. To tax it again seems a little strange to me.
Exactly. Especially when the feds don't. So, anyway.
That's true. And it doesn't, but it gets taxed when it goes back out as wages again.
Yes. So it's just, it would not, the business profits, the business would not get taxed on profits. So, and, you know, I think as people learn what was intended by the feds and how we were going to be different, it had bipartisan support. So, as well, I think it should have.
Here's one you can kind of outline for me. Senate Bill 20, Career and Technical Education. It allows for a one-year certificate to teach without a bachelor's degree. Now, I'm thinking like adjunct faculty in colleges and things like that. This would apply to public schools?
So I'm pulling... individuals applying to teach in a continuing education specialty area from a bachelor's degree requirement for 1 year. So it gives, I think, people a chance to get that certificate, even as it allows them to actually teach that course in the CTE.
Is that renewable or is that a one-time event?
I believe it's a one-time event.
Okay. I appreciate you checking that up for me. What time is it? 12:49 here on WASR. If you have a question or a comment, 569-5253. That's 569-LAKE. I also noticed that we have a new official state spider. Evidently... Somebody thought that was important. We have the daring jumping spider. I don't know if you had heard about this. I caught this on the internet today.
I remember some chatter about it, but I have to admit, with hundreds of pieces of legislation, some of it goes in one ear and out.
Yes.
Poor jumping spider. I hope he didn't jump in my ear and have to jump out the other. I hope he just bypassed me, and that's why I didn't know about him.
Well, now you've earned some much-deserved time off for the slow season. However, looking at September, what did Alicia Preston Sampopoulos
say? So what will happen now in July and August, legislature largely shuts down. There are no hearings, very few study committees. But starting in September, the bills that got held over for study, so you either pass a bill, you kill a bill, or the third option is you hold a bill for further work and study. And so that process, the committee process, will start up generally again in September and October, and then those bills will go on the calendar in January in either the House or Senate.
Who decides which bills are worked on when? Is that a function of the different committees?
Yeah. What happens is, in both the House and Senate, in order for a bill to go to study, at least in the Senate, it has to go to the floor and be voted to send back to the committee. In the House, a committee can actually vote to retain a bill and then study it over, the following fall. So then it falls to the chair of the committee to determine, you know, exactly when the committee will meet. But generally, it's in September, October timeframe. My guess is that you know, we've all gone through a pretty difficult session in terms of trying to get the work done and doing it remotely. It's just a lot harder, you know, to have done what we did remotely. And it's rather remarkable, I think, that our staff, you know, did such a great job of utilizing the technology that enabled it to happen. I mean, it really was pretty remarkable. But I think people are, you know, a little bit worn out and take a break and come back.
Yeah, well, it's definitely well deserved. Are there any particular bills that you're anxious to pick up in September?
Well, I'm really glad the budget passed. I think that, you know, that had been in doubt for a while. So I think, you know, that was the biggest bill of the entire session. You know, I'm going to be monitoring the broadband bill a lot. I will be part of the group that will work with the governor's office and the fiscal committee on how to dispense with some of the federal monies that are coming into the state. So, you know, that's another thing that that'll be an ongoing thing. So, you know, I think that'll take up quite a bit of time.
Okay. It's 12:53 here on WASR. You're listening to Jeb Bradley, Senate Majority Leader and Wolfboro resident. As long as we're on the subject, it's going to start to get very, very warm. Can you? I know this is a passion of yours, hiking. How does hot weather hiking differ? Obviously, the temperatures, but is it different from any other kinds of hiking in different climates?
Oh, absolutely different. You know, it's very different. I mean, I've done a lot of hiking out west and in desert-type conditions, some of the canyons in Arizona, Utah, Colorado in particular. It's beautiful hiking out there. Even, you know, some of the mountains out there where it is hotter. But in particular, in canyon hiking, I climbed to the base of the Grand Canyon in August, you know, 10 years ago, and, you know, started at 5 in the morning at the rim, the south rim of the Grand Canyon, and it was probably 40 to 45 degrees, and I was wearing a down vest and a hoodie, and, you know, by the time the sun came up, I was, you know, a good 1,000 feet lower, stripped down, you know, to like a hiking shirt and a t-shirt. But by the time, you know, 2 hours later, we were approaching the Colorado River and the bridge to cross over to, you know, where we were going to spend the night. And, you know, it's 110 to 115 degrees and bright sun. And so, you know, you got to be prepared for that's as dangerous, quite frankly, as, you know, 10 below or 20 below zero in the winter in the White Mountains. So you have to be prepared and know, you know, what you need and what you need to do. But hiking in the White Mountains in the summer is just a beautiful experience. You got to deal with thunderstorms. You know, that, like any other weather situation, you've got to be well aware of. But the days are longer, it's warmer. But when it's 80 degrees or, you know, even 90 degrees, you know, in Wolfboro, it's probably only 50 degrees or maybe 60 at the top of, you know, Mount Washington. So the winds will be different. So it's, you know, you still have to be prepared, but it's a lot different than zero in the winter.
Yeah, I can imagine. Am I the only one who has visions of Charlton Heston and the Ten Commandments, you know, walking across the desert? I think maybe it's just me. You had to be there.
You know, I've never done that kind of desert hiking. It's mostly been canyon hiking, but it's basically a desert. You do have some shelter from the sun, at least in a canyon. But some of them are pretty broad too, and it gets very hot, and you got to have a big broad brimmed hat and fully clothed, you know, and how you stay cool is pretty interesting. When we climbed out of the Grand Canyon, the trail we came up, we went down one way and up the other. And at about the halfway point of the way up, there's a small stream. And thankfully, it had some water in it. And I remember I just took my shoes off and jumped in the water with all my clothes on. And we rested for a few minutes and ate something, drank something, put my shoes back on, and you know, I was wet for about an hour until I totally dried off, and just kept walking through really hot weather.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I've never been to like Phoenix. I've never seen 115 degrees. It's hot, but
that's
anyway.
Hot.
We are just about out of time, Senator. Thank you very much for being with us today. I appreciate it, and enjoy your weekend. If you're going to go out hiking, please be careful.
I will. You too.
All right.
Hope everybody has a good weekend. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. You take care.
Bye.
I know. It is 12:59 as we come up on 1 o'clock here on WASR. Don't forget, Monday is Mike and the Hoss. It's our live sports show from 4 to 5, Monday and Thursday, here on AM 1420 and FM 97.1 WASR. News is next.